fascinating. Anyone got another pencil? Said Ridcully.
It's had four already, said the lecturer in recent runes, right down to the stub, Arch-Chancellor, and you know we buy our own these days.
It was a sore point. Like most people with no grasp whatsoever of real economics, Mustrum Ridcully equated proper financial control with the counting of paper clips. Even senior wizards had to produce a pencil stub to him before they were allowed a new one out of the locked cupboard below his desk. Since, of course, hardly anyone retained a half-used pencil, the wizards had been reduced to sneaking out and buying new ones with their own money. The reason for the dearth of short pencils was perched in front of them, whirring away as it chewed an HB down to the eraser on the end, which it spat at the bursar. Ponder Stibbons had been making notes.
"I think it works like this," he said. "What we're getting is the personification of forces, just like Hex said, but it only works if the thing is, well, logical."
He swallowed. Ponder was a great believer in logic, in the face of all the local evidence, and he hated having to use the word in this way.
"I don't mean it's logical that there's a creature that eats socks, but it makes a sort of sense. I mean it's a working hypothesis."
"Bit like the Hogfather," said Ridcully. "When you're a kiddie, he's as good an explanation as any, right?" "What's not logical about there being a goblin that brings me huge bags of money?" said the Dean sulkily. Ridcully fed the stealer of pencils another pencil.
"Well, sir, firstly, you've never mysteriously received huge bags of money and needed to find a hypothesis to explain them, and secondly, no one else would think it at all likely."
"Huh. Why is it happening now?" said Ridcully. "Look, it's hopped onto my finger. Anyone got another pencil?"
"Well, these forces have always been here," said Ponder. "I mean, socks and pencils have always inexplicably gone missing, haven't they? But why they're suddenly getting personified like this, I'm afraid I don't know."
"Well, we'd better find out, hadn't we?" said Ridcully. "Can't have this sort of thing going on. Daft anti-gods and miscellaneous whatnots being created just because people have thought about them. We could have anything turn up, anyway. Supposing some idiot says there must be a god of indigestion, eh?"
Glingle, 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 glingle.
I think someone just did, sir," said Ponder.
"What's the matter? What's the matter?" said the O-God. He took Susan by the shoulders. They felt bony under his hands. "Damn!" said Susan. She pushed him away and steadied herself on the table, taking care that he didn't see her face. Finally, with a measure of the self-control she'd taught herself over the last few years, she managed to get her own voice back. "He's slipping out of character," she muttered, to the hall in general. "I can feel him doing it, and that drags me in. What's he doing it all for?"
"Search me," said the O-God, who'd backed away hurriedly. Just then, before you turned your face away, it looked as though you were wearing very dark eyeshadow, only you weren't..."
"Look, it's very simple," said Susan, spinning round. She could feel her hair restyling itself, which it always did when it was anxious. "You know how stuff runs in families? Blue eyes, buck teeth, that sort of thing. Well, death runs in my family."
In everybody's family, doesn't it?" said the O-God.
"Just shut up, please. Don't gabble," said Susan. "I didn't mean death. I meant
death,
with a capital D. I remember things that haven't happened yet, and I can
talk that talk and stalk that stalk, and if he gets sidetracked, then I'll have to do it. And he does get sidetracked.
I don't know what's really happened to the real Hogfather or why Grandfather's doing his job, but I know a bit about how he thinks, and he's got no mental shields like we have. He doesn't know how to forget things or ignore things. He takes everything literally and logically and doesn't understand why that doesn't always work." She saw his bemused expression.
"Look, how would you make sure everyone in the world was well fed?" she demanded.
"Me? Oh, well,
The O-God spluttered for a moment.
"I suppose you'd have to think about the prevalent political systems and the proper division and cultivation of arable land and..."
"Yes, yes. But he'd just give everyone a good meal," said Susan.
"Oh, I see. Very impractical. It's as silly as saying you could clothe the naked by, giving them some clothes."
"Yes,
I mean, no, of course not. I mean, obviously you'd give... Oh, you know what I mean.
Yes, I suppose so.
But he wouldn't. There was a crash beside them. A burning wheel always rolls out of flaming wreckage. Two men carrying a large sheet of glass always cross the road in front of any comedy actor involved in a crazy car chase. Some narrative conventions are so strong that equivalents happen even on planets where the rocks boil at noon. And when a fully laden table collapses, one miraculously unbroken plate always rolls across the floor and spins to a halt. Susan and the Ogod watched it, and then turned their attention to the huge figure now lying in what remained of an enormous centerpiece made of fruit.
"He just came right out of the air," whispered the Ogod.
"Really? Don't just stand there. Give me a hand to help him up, will you?" said Susan, pulling at a large melon.
That's a bunch of grapes behind his ear."
"Well?"
"I don't like even to think about grapes."
"Oh, come on." Together they managed to get the newcomer onto his feet. "Toga? Sandals? He looks a bit like you," said Susan, as the fruit victim swayed heavily.
"Was I that green colour? Close?"
Is there a privy nearby?"
mumbled their burden through clammy lips. "I believe it's through that arch over there," said Susan. "I've heard it's not very pleasant, though."
"That's not a rumour, that's a forecast," said the fat figure and lurched off. "And then can I please have a glass of water and one charcoal biscuit?"
They watched him go. "Friend of yours?" said Susan.
"God of indigestion, I think. Look, I think I do remember something," said the Ogod. "Just before I, incarnated. But it sounds stupid."
"Well?"
"Teeth," said the Ogod.
Susan hesitated. "You don't mean something attacking you, do you?" she said flatly.
"No, just a sensation of toothiness. Probably doesn't mean much. As God of hangovers, I see a lot worse, I can tell you."
"Just teeth. Lots of teeth, but not horrible teeth. Just lots and lots of little teeth. Almost sad."
"Yes. How did you know?"
"Oh, maybe I remember you telling me before you told me. I don't know. How about a big, shiny red globe?" The Ogod looked thoughtful for a moment and then said,
"No, can't help you there, I'm afraid. It's just teeth, rows and rows of teeth."
"I don't remember rows," said Susan. "I just felt teeth were important."
"Nah, it's amazing what you can do with a beak," said the raven, who'd been investigating the laden table and had succeeded in levering a lid off a jar.
"What have you got there?" said Susan wearily.
"Eyeballs," said the raven. "Ah, wizards know how to live all right, eh? They don't want for nothing around here, I can tell you."
"They are olives," said Susan.
"Tough luck," said the raven. "They're mine now."
"They're a kind of fruit, or a vegetable or something."
"You sure?"
The raven swiveled one doubtful eye on the jar and the other on her.
"Yes."
The eyes swiveled again.
"So you're an eyeball expert all of a sudden?"
"Look, they're green, you stupid bird."
"They could be very old eyeballs," said the raven defiantly. "Sometimes they go like that." "Squeak," said the Death of Rats, who was halfway through a cheese.
"And not so much of the stupid," said the raven. "Corvids are exceptionally bright with reasoning and, in the case of some forest species, tool-using abilities."
"Oh, so you are an expert on ravens, are you?" said Susan.
"Madam, I happen to be a..." "Squeak," said the Death of Rats again.
They both turned. It was pointing at its grey teeth.
"The Tooth Fairy?" said Susan. "What about her?"
"Squeak!"
"Rows of teeth," said the Ogod again. "Like, rows, you know. What's the Tooth Fairy?"
"Oh, you see her around a lot these days," said Susan. "Or them, rather. It's a sort of franchise operation. You get the ladder, the money belt and the pliers, and you're set up."
"Pliers?"
"If she can't make change, she has to take an extra tooth on account. But look, the Tooth Fairies are harmless enough. I've met one or two of them. They're just working girls. They don't menace anyone.
Squeak!
I just hope Grandfather doesn't take it into his head to do their job as well. Good grief, the thought of it.
They collect teeth?
Well, yes, obviously.
Why?
Why? It's their job.
I meant, why, where do they take the teeth after they collect them?
I don't know. They just take the teeth and leave the money, said Susan. What sort of a question is that? Where do they take the teeth?
I just wondered, that's all. Probably all humans know. I'm probably very silly for asking. It's probably a well-known fact.
Susan looked thoughtfully at the death of rats. Actually, where do they take the teeth?
Squeak. He says search him, said the raven. Maybe they sell 'em.
It pecked at another jar.
How about these? These look nice and wrinkly.
Pickled walnuts, said Susan absently. What do they do with the teeth? What use is there for a lot of teeth? But what harm can a tooth fairy do?
Have we got time to find one and ask her? Said the Ogod.
Time isn't the problem, said Susan.
There are those who believe knowledge is something that is acquired, a precious ore, hacked, as it were, from the grey strata of ignorance. There are those who believe that knowledge can only be recalled, that there was some golden age in the distant past when everything was known and the stones fitted together so you could hardly put a knife between them, you know, and it's obvious that they had flying machines, right, because of the way the earthworks can only be seen from above, yeah? And there's this museum I read about where they found a pocket calculator under the altar of this ancient temple, you know what I'm saying? But the government, like, hushed it up.
It's amazing how good governments are, given their track record in almost every other field, at hushing up things like alien encounters. One reason may be that the aliens themselves are too embarrassed to talk about it. It's not known why most of the space-going races of the universe want to undertake rummaging in Earthling underwear as a prelude to formal contact, but representatives of several hundred races have taken to hanging out, unsuspected by one another, in rural corners of the planet, and as a result of this keep on abducting other would-be abductees. Some have been in fact abducted while waiting to carry out an abduction on a couple of other aliens trying to abduct the aliens who were, as a result of misunderstood instructions, trying to form cattle into circles and mutilate crops. The planet Earth is now banned to all alien races until they can compare notes and find out how many, if any, real humans they have actually got. It is gloomily suspected that there is only one, who is big, hairy, and has very large feet. The truth may be out there, but lies are inside your head. Mustrum Ridcully believed that knowledge could be acquired by shouting at people, and was endeavouring to do so. The wizards were sitting around the uncommon room table, which was piled high with books.
"It is Hogswatch, Arch-Chancellor," said the Dean reproachfully, thumbing through an ancient volume.
"Not until midnight," said Ridcully. "Sorting this out will give you fellows an appetite for your dinner."
"I think I might have something, Arch-Chancellor," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "This is Waddley's Basic Gods. There's some stuff here about Lares and Penates that seems to fit the bill."
"Lares and Penates? What were they when they were at home?" said Ridcully.
"Ha-ha-ha-ha," said the Chair.
"What?" said Ridcully.
"I thought you were making a rather good joke, Arch-Chancellor," said the Chair.
"Was I?"
"I didn't mean to," said Ridcully.
"Nothing new there," said the Dean under his breath.
"What was that, Dean?" "Nothing, Arch-Chancellor."
"I thought you made the reference at home because they are, in fact, household gods. Or were, rather. They seemed to have faded away long ago. They were little spirits of the house, like, for example—"
Three of the other wizards, thinking quite fast for wizards, clapped their hands over his mouth.
"Careful," said Ridcully. "Careless talk creates lives. That's why we've got a big, fat god of indigestion being ill in the privy. By the way, where's the bursar?"
"He was in the privy, Arch-Chancellor," said the lecturer in recent runes.
"What, when the—"
"Yes, Arch-Chancellor."
"Oh, well, I'm sure he'll be all right," said Ridcully, in the matter-of-fact voice of someone contemplating something nasty that was happening to someone else out of earshot. "But we don't want any more of these, what are they, Chair?"
"Lares and Penates, Arch-Chancellor, but I wasn't suggesting—"
"Seems clear to me something's gone wrong, and these little devils are coming back.
All we have to do is find out what's gone wrong and put it right."
"Oh, well, I'm glad that's all sorted out," said the Dean.
"Household gods," said Ridcully. "That's what they are, Chair?"
He opened the drawer in his hat and took out his pipe.
"Yes, Arch-Chancellor. It says here they used to be the local spirits, I suppose. They saw to it that the bread rose and the butter churned properly."
"Did they eat pencils? What was their attitude in the socks department?"
This was back in the time of the First Empire," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "Sandals and togas and so on."
"Ah, not noticeably socked?"
"Not excessively so, no. And it was 900 years before Osric Pensilium, first discovered in the graphite-rich sands of the remote island of Sumtri, the small bush which, by dint of careful cultivation, he induced to produce the long..."
"Yes, we can all see you've got the encyclopedia open under the table, Chair," said Ridcully, "but I dare say things have changed a bit. Moved with the times. Bound to have been a few developments, hm? Once they looked after the bread rising, now we have things that eat pencils and socks, and see to it that you can never find a clean towel when you want one."
There was a distant tinkling. He stopped. "I just said that, didn't I?" he said. The wizards nodded glumly.
"And this is the first time anyone's mentioned it?"
The wizards nodded again.
"Well, damn it, it's amazing you can never find a clean towel when you..."
There was a rising whee noise. A towel went by at shoulder height. There was a suggestion of many small wings.
"That was mine," said the lecturer in recent runes, reproachfully. The towel disappeared in the direction of the great hall. "Towel wasps," said the Dean. "Well done, Arch-Chancellor."
"Well, I mean, damn it, it's human nature, isn't it?" said Ridcully hotly. "Things go wrong, things get lost. It's natural to invent little creatures that..." all right, I'll be careful. I'm just saying man is naturally a mythopoeic creature."
"What's that mean?" said the senior wrangler.
"Means we make up things as we go along," said the Dean, not looking up.
Excuse me, gentlemen," said Ponder Stibbons, who had been scribbling thoughtfully at the end of the table. "Are we suggesting that things are coming back? Do we think that's a viable hypothesis?"
The wizards looked at one another around the table.
"Definitely viable. Viable, right enough."
"Yes, that's the stuff to give the troops."
"What is? What's the stuff to give the troops?"
"Well, tinned rations, decent weapons, good boots, that sort of thing."
"What's that got to do with anything?"
"Don't ask me. He was the one who started talking about giving stuff to the troops."
"Will you lot shut up? No one's giving anything to the troops."
"Oh, shouldn't they have something? Oh, it's Hogswatch night, after all."
"Look, it was just a figure of speech, all right? I just meant I was fully in agreement. It's just colourful language."
"Good grief, you surely can't think I'm actually suggesting giving stuff to the troops at Hogswatch or any other time."
"You weren't?"
"No."
"That's a bit mean, isn't it?"
Ponder just let it happen. It's because their minds are so often involved with deep and problematical matters, he told himself, that their mouths are allowed to wander around making a nuisance of themselves.
"I don't hold with using that thinking machine," said the Dean. "I've said this before, it's meddling with the cult. The occult has always been good enough for me, thank you very much. On the other hand, it's the only person round here who can think straight, and it does what it's told," said Ridcully.
The sleigh roared through the snow, leaving rolling trails in the sky. "Oh, what fun," muttered Albert, hanging on tightly. The runners hit a roof near the university and the pigs trotted to a halt. Death looked at the hourglass again.
"Odd," he said.
"It's a scythe job, then," said Albert. "You won't be wanting the full speed and the jolly laugh."
He looked around and puzzlement replaced sarcasm.
"Hey, how could anyone be dead up here?"
Someone was. A corpse lay in the snow. It was clear that the man had only just died. Albert squinted up at the sky.
"There's nowhere to fall from, and there's no footprints in the snow," he said, as Death swung his scythe. "So where did he come from?"
"Looks like someone's personal guard. Been stabbed to death. Nasty knife wound there, see?"
"It's not good," agreed the spirit of the man, looking down at himself. Then he stared from himself to Albert, to Death, and his phantom expression went from shock to concern.
"They got the teeth, all of them. They just walked in, and they... No, wait!"
He faded and was gone.
"Well, what was all that about?" said Albert.
"I have my suspicions."
"See the badge on his shirt? Looks like a drawing of a tooth."
"Yes, it does."
"Where's that come from?"
"A place I cannot go."
Albert looked down at the mysterious corpse, and then back up at Death's impassive skull.
"I keep thinking it was a funny thing us bumping into your granddaughter like that," he said.
"Yes."
Albert put his head on one side.
"Given the large number of chimneys and kids in the world, etc."
"Indeed."
"Amazing coincidence, really."
"It just goes to show."
"Hard to believe, you might say."
"Life certainly springs a few surprises."
"Not just life, I reckon," said Albert. "And she got real worked up, didn't she? Flew right off the old handle. Wouldn't be surprised if she started asking questions."
"That's people for you."
"But Rat is hanging around, ain't he? He'll probably keep an eye socket on her. Guide her path, probably."
"He is a little scamp, isn't he?"
Albert knew he couldn't win. Death had the ultimate poker face.
"I'm sure she'll act sensibly."
"Oh, yeah," said Albert as they walked back to the sleigh. "It runs in the family, acting sensibly."
Like many barmen, Igor kept a club under the bar to deal with those little upsets that occurred around closing time, although in fact beers never closed and no one could ever remember not seeing Igor behind the bar. Nevertheless, things sometimes got out of hand, or paw, or talon. Igor's weapon of choice was a little different. It was tipped with silver for werewolves, hung with garlic for vampires, and wrapped around with a strip of blanket for bogeymen. For everyone else, the fact that it was 2 feet of solid bog oak usually sufficed. He'd been watching the window. The frost was creeping across it. For some reason, the creeping fingers were forming into a pattern of 3 little dogs looking out of a boot. Then someone had tapped him on the shoulder. He spun round, club already in his hand, and relaxed.
"Oh, it's you, miss. I didn't hear the door."
There hadn't been the door. Susan was in a hurry.
"Have you seen Violet lately, Igor?"
"The tooth girl?"
Igor's one eyebrow writhed in concentration.
Nah, haven't seen her for a week or two."
The eyebrow furrowed into a V of annoyance as he spotted the raven, which tried to shuffle behind a half-empty display card of beer nuts.
"You can get that out of here, miss," he said. "You know the rule about pets and familiars. If it can't turn back into human on demand, it's out."
"Yeah, well, some of us have more brain cells than fingers," muttered a voice from behind the beer nuts.
"Where does she live?"
"Now, miss, you know I never answers questions like that." "Where does she live, Igor?" "Shamlegger Street, next to the picture framers,"
said Igor automatically. The eyebrow knotted in anger as he realised what he'd said.
"Now, miss, you know the rules. I don't get bitten, I don't get me throat torn out, and no one hides behind me door, and you don't try your granddad's voice on me. I could ban you for messing me about like that."
"Sorry, it's important," said Susan.
Out of the corner of her eye, she could see that the raven had crept onto the shelves and was pecking the top off a jar.
"Yeah, well, suppose one of the vampires decides it's important he's missed his tea,"
grumbled Igor, putting the club away. There was a plink from the direction of the pickled egg jar. Susan tried hard not to look.
"Can we go?" said the Ogod. "All this alcohol makes me nervous."
Susan nodded and hurried out. Igor grunted. Then he went back to watching the frost, because Igor never demanded much out of life. After a while, he heard a muffled voice say,
"I want one! I want one!"
It was indistinct because the raven had speared a pickled egg with its beak. Igor sighed and picked up his club. And it would have gone very hard for the raven if the death of rats hadn't chosen that moment to bite Igor on the ear.
"Down there," said Death.
The reins were hauled so sharply, so quickly, that the hogs ended up facing the other way. Albert fought his way out of a drift of teddy bears where he'd been dozing.
"What's up? What's up? Did we hit something?" he said.
Death pointed downwards. An endless white snowfield lay below, only the occasional glow of a window candle or a half-covered hut indicating the presence on this world of brief mortality. Albert squinted and then saw what Death had spotted.
"Some old bugger trudging through the snow," he said. "Been gathering wood by the look of it."
"Bad night to be out," he said. "And I'm out in it too, come to that. Look, master, I'm sure you've done enough now to make sure—"
"Something's happening down there, ho, ho, ho!"
"Look, he's all right," said Albert, hanging on as the sleigh tumbled downwards.
There was a brief wedge of light below as the wood-gatherer opened the door of a snow-drifted hovel.
"See over there, there's a couple of blokes catching him up. Look, they're weighed down with parcels and stuff, see? He's going to have a decent hog's watch after all. No problem there. Now, can we go?"
Death's glowing eye sockets took in the scene in minute detail.
"It's wrong."
"Oh, no. Here we go again."
The O-God hesitated. "What do you mean you can't walk through the door?" said Susan. "You walked through the door in the bar."
"That was different. I have certain godlike powers in the presence of alcohol. Anyway, we've knocked and she hasn't answered, and whatever happened to Mr. Manners?"
Susan shrugged and walked through the cheap woodwork. She knew she probably shouldn't. Every time she did something like this, she used up a certain amount of, well, normal. And sooner or later, she'd forget what doorknobs were for, just like Grandfather. Come to think of it, he'd never found out what doorknobs were for. She opened the door from the inside. The O-God stepped in and looked around. This did not take long. It was not a large room. It had been subdivided from a room that itself hadn't been all that big to start with.
"This is where the Tooth Fairy lives," Bilious said. "It's a bit pokey, isn't it? Stuff all over the floor. What are these things hanging from the line?"
"They are women's clothes," said Susan, rummaging through the paperwork on a small rickety table.
"They're not very big," said the O-God, "and a bit thin."
"Tell me," said Susan without looking up, "these memories you arrived here with, they weren't very complicated, were they?"
"Ah."
He looked over her shoulder as she opened a small red notebook. "I've only talked to Violet a few times," she said. "I think she delivers the teeth somewhere and gets a percentage of the money. It's not a highly paid line of work. You know, they say you can earn dollars in your spare time. But she says really she could earn more money waiting on tables." "Ah, this looks right."
"What's that?"
"She said she gets given the names every week."
"What, of the children who are going to lose teeth?"
"Yes, names and addresses," said Susan, flicking through the pages.
"That doesn't sound very likely."
"Pardon me, but are you the god of hangovers? Oh, look, here's Twyla's tooth last month." She smiled at the neat grey writing. "She practically hammered it out because she needed the half dollar."
"Do you like children?" said the O-God.
She gave him a look. "Not raw," she said. "Other people's are okay. Hold on." She flicked some pages back and forth. "There's just blank days," she said. "Look, the last few days all unticked, no names. But if you go back a week or two, look, they're all properly marked off and the money added up at the bottom of the page, see?"
"And this can't be right, can it?"
"There were only 5 names entered on the first unticked night for the previous week. Most children instinctively knew when to push their luck, and only the greedy or dentally improvident called out the Tooth Fairy around Hogswatch."
"Read the names," said Susan. "William Whittles, a.k.a. Willy, home, Tosser, school, second floor back bedroom 68 Kicklebury Street. Sophie Langtree, a.k.a. Daddy's Princess, attic bedroom 5 The Hippo. The Hon Geoffrey Bibbleton, a.k.a. Trouble in Trousers, home, 4 Eyes, school, first floor back, Scroat Manor, Park Lane." He stopped.
"I say, this is a bit intrusive, isn't it?"
"It's a whole new world," said Susan. "You haven't got there yet. Keep going."
"Nuhakme Iktar, a.k.a. Little Jewel, basement, The Laughing Falafel, Clatchistan Takeaway and All-Night Grocery, corner, Soak and Dimwell. Reginald Lillywhite, a.k.a. Banjo, The Park Lane Bully, Have You Seen This Man, The Goose Gate Grabber, The Nap Hill Lurker, Room 17, YMPA.
YMPA?
It's what we generally call the Young Men's Reformed Cultists of the Ikor God Bel Shahamroth Association, said Susan. Does that sound to you like someone who'd expect a visit from a tooth fairy?
No.
Me neither. He sounds like someone who'd expect a visit from the Watch.